Our final group of cases today are 700-26-26 in re Kelly Amicon Property Trust and 70025 in re Brindley Amicon Property Trust. We have Mr. Shapiro, Mr. Grover, representing the appellant and respondent. Thank you for allowing us to do these all at one time. I'll give each side 20 minutes in case you need it. That doesn't mean you have to use it, but each side will have 20 minutes.
No,
that's fine. I just wanted to make sure you don't short touch at all. I wouldn't do that.
Thank you. I'm glad I'm picking up for marijuana.
I'm joking.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Shapiro. I present the Brent Whitehead, who's the appellant and the trustee of the Brindley Amicon Property Trust and the Keeley Amicon Property Trust. We're here today on a matter of first impression. We're here today on a statute that was passed in 2015. It was Senate Bill 484, originally codified as Section 73, later turned into NRS 165 and 1207. The specific provision of issue is an exception that is found in that section. In subparagraph A, it imposes the duty upon trustees to provide an accounting to all mandatory and discretionary beneficiaries. Subsection B delineates a number of exceptions to that, and we're talking about section number 5, which states that a trustee is not required to provide an account to a beneficiary of an irrevocable trust while that beneficiary's only interest in the trust estate is a discretionary interest as described in NRS 163-4185. Now, in this case, we have a trust. Well, there's two trusts, but they're identical in all respects. The trust provides that the beneficiary has a current discretionary interest. If there are funds left in the trust at the time that the beneficiary turns 35, the beneficiary will get a third of those funds. At age 40, they'll get a half, and at age 45, they get the remainder. So we have a current discretionary interest and a future or remainder mandatory interest. The district court ruled that the exception did not apply because there were two interests in the estate. There was a remainder interest, which was a mandatory interest, and a current discretionary interest. We sought this court's interpretation on it because it is a new statute, because there's inconsistencies with that rule.
Why isn't this legal question answered by the provisions in subsection 3 of NRS 163.4185?
I'm sorry, say that again, Your Honor.
Why isn't this question answered by subsection 3 of 163.4185, which says, if a trust provides for a support interest that also includes mandatory language, but the mandatory language is qualified by discretionary language, the support interest must be classified and separated as a discretionary interest. So, aren't the interests here a discretionary interest? I mean, the remainder that's to be paid out in this case is a mandatory interest by itself, but the same individual who's getting those distributions is the same individual who's getting the income or the support interest, right?
It is, Your Honor.
And the trustee has the discretion under the provisions of both of these trusts to make discretionary distributions, right?
Yes.
So why isn't even though there are both interests, doesn't this statute say that those are to be treated as discretionary interests?
Your Honor, I agree with that. And unfortunately, I didn't see that enough in the beginning to make the argument, but I agree with that analysis.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of conversation here about what this new statute talks about, but it all references in subsection 5, 163.4185. And it seems to me that the section 3 addresses the possibility that there could be combined interests, in which case they're supposed to be treated as discretionary interests.
I can shut up and sit down, but I've prepared some arguments. So
I'm just asking the question, I don't know.
I agree with you, Justice Hardesty, but I guess to go to the arguments that were raised, the problem that I see with the district court's interpretation is that the district court accepts all interests in the trust as if they're all current interests. The reality is when a trust is created, a trust can create multiple different types of interest in a beneficiary. But all of those interests, no matter if they're current interests or future interests, no matter if they're mandatory or discretionary, no matter if they're vested or contingent, all of those interests are created at the moment the trust is created. And at that moment, whatever interest beneficiary has, they have. The interpretation by the district court to say that because there's a future mandatory interest, this exception doesn't apply, fails to take into account the timing of the interests. And the legislature's use of the word while is instructive, because the legislature, all of those interests exist. In every case, there's no exception to that. Every time there's a trust, those interests are going to exist the moment the trust is created. So by using the word while, you have to look at the timing of those interests. And when you look at the timing of the interests, then while the interest is a discretionary interest, there's no counting. But when it changes, if it changes, then the counting is required. Now, the other side focuses on the word only. And admittedly, that creates problems because a trust is always going to have whatever interests there are. The only way you can interpret the word while and only together is if you look at timing. Because if a party has two interests at the beginning, they're always going to have two interests. If they only have one interest when the trust is formed, they're always going to have one interest. The example, I'll give you another example that illustrates the issue. Let's assume there's a trust that provides that the beneficiary, we'll say Brinley, the trustee is required to pay Brinley's housing expenses while Brinley's in college. So high school, college, grad college, whatever they want. But once college is over, then she's on her own for housing expenses. But the trustee is given discretion to pay all other expenses. In that scenario, you would have a case where the beneficiary has a current mandatory right and a current discretionary interest. So under our proposed interpretation of the exception, the trustee would be required to give an accounting. Now, what happens when Brinley graduates from college and is no longer attending school? The mandatory interest expires. What's left? Solely a discretionary interest. Under the district court's interpretation, the trustee would have to continue to give an accounting through the rest of Brinley's life, even though her only remaining interest is a discretionary interest. We don't believe that's the intent of the language, and that interpretation would ignore the word while, which indicates you have to take timing into account. And so, it's our position that in order to give effect to the meaning of the word while, you have to look at the timing of the different interests. Justice Gibbons, did you have a question? I don't know. Does it sound like we're going to interrupt you and decided not to?
No.
Okay. Well, unless the court has any questions, let me... I'll reserve the rest for a moment.
Well, I've got a question. The discretionary aspect of the trust, was there anything that necessitated support coming from the trust over a period of time? I wasn't quite clear on that. But my understanding was that may or may not require.
It is. It's total discretion currently. Now, I can't say, because I have knowledge, it's not necessarily part of the record, but the trustee is making distributions currently. They are requesting, distributions the trustee is making, but it is 100% discretionary currently. They can distribute all of it or none of it.
So, at the end, when the discretionary period ends, there may not be anything left.
That's correct.
Okay, so now go to the policy of the exceptions. And requiring an accounting, it can be an onerous, costly process. And so I view that as one of the reasons why the exception was created. Can you comment on that?
Well, I can. And Your Honor, I do believe that that is the intent of the statute, is to try and reduce the expense. The reality is these trusts are created for the benefit of someone. And we want to get as much money to that someone as possible. And so we want to reduce the burden. Now, you have to balance the discretionary and mandatory. If it's mandatory, then the beneficiary has an interest, unquestionably. And so that is the balance that the legislature struck. They said, while it's discretionary, then we're going to keep it down and provide the benefits. When it's mandatory, we're going to force the trustee to spend the time and money to provide an accounting. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Respondent.
Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Court, my name is Thomas Grover, my number is 12387, and I'm here on behalf of the respondents, Keely Amacon and Brittany Amacon. Just kind of an overview, I'm going to hit on really two main points, address some of the issues that were raised in the argument that's already been made, and then, of course, at any point along the way, I'm open to taking questions. The two main points that I really wanted to drive home to begin are, first, the plain meaning of the exception, that's 12071B. And then second, I want to discuss the difference between discretionary and mandatory interests, what that is, and almost as importantly, what that isn't in the discussion today. Mr. Shapiro did a nice job summarizing the facts, which are largely undisputed here. We have two trusts that were created to benefit two sisters, Brittany and Keely, and the key portions of those trusts that's being discussed today and that arises on this appeal are sections 2.1 and sections 2.2. Under 2.1, the trustee has discretion to make distributions, but it's not unlimited discretion. I think that's very important to note. It's stated right at the beginning of those sections that the purpose of this trust is for the support of Brittany and Keely. So this isn't a trust where we have one current discretionary beneficiary and then a second or different remainder beneficiary that may or may not eventually get something. Ultimately, everything in these trusts exists for the benefit of Brittany and Keegan.
So, counsel, you would agree, I presume, that those sections of the trust fit the definition of a support interest in NRS 163.4185, subsection B, which is defined as a support interest contains a standard for distribution for the support of a person which may be interpreted by the trustee or a court as necessary. In addition to that, it adds a sentence that says a provision in a trust which provides a support interest may contain mandatory language which a trustee must follow. I presume it's the former.
I respectfully would make a little bit of a distinction between the two, and I think this is an important point. That is an important question that's been asked. Section 2.1 is the discretionary current interest, and under that provision, the trustee does have discretion within the boundary of a HEM standard to do as he pleases.
There is.
But the Section 2.2 is a mandatory interest. And that's important because the trustee doesn't have discretion. When the beneficiaries turn 35, 40, and 45, there must be a distribution made in specific.
So the mandatory support provision would be subsection 1A of 163.4185, which says a mandatory interest if the trustee has no discretion to determine whether a distribution should be made, when a distribution should be made, or the amount of distribution. Doesn't subsection 3 of 163.4185 say when you have both of these, they're to be treated as a discretionary interest?
I would argue respectfully, I think subsection 3 addresses a specific interest in themselves. It doesn't necessarily address we've got two separate interests. We have two different interests here, section 2.1 of the trust and section 2.2. Section 2.1 of the trust, I think, can be construed as both a support interest and a discretionary interest. But section 2.2 is clearly a mandatory interest. And I think this is, there's a really important distinction to be made here.
If that's true, section 3 says if a trust provides for a support interest that also includes mandatory language, but the mandatory language is qualified by discretionary language, the support interest must be classified and separated as a discretionary interest. Doesn't that make both of those provisions a discretionary interest?
No, because section 2.2 of the trust is not made conditioned upon support, it's not made conditioned upon the judgment of the trustee. Section 1A of 4185 is disjunctive. And in contrast, subsection C is disjunctive. So in other words,
the mandatory interest only provides for a distribution of anything that's left.
That's correct.
So it's all it's totally dependent upon the discretionary interest. If the trustee has distributed the full trust before those ages are achieved, there's nothing to be distributed. Isn't that true?
The consequence of that is true, but the actual decision to make the distribution in that scenario doesn't leave the trustee, as to that specific interest, any discretion. He has no discretion whether a distribution will be made under Section 2.2. He has no discretion as to when the distribution will be made or how much. And in order for it to be a mandatory interest, only one of those three have to be met under Section 1A, and yet here we have all three of them met. And so for that reason, Section 2.2 is a mandatory interest, and really only a mandatory interest. And the fact that there are two different interests, and the second one, 2.2, is a mandatory interest, is the key distinction that the district court made when concluding that the beneficiaries have a right to an accounting.
It doesn't appear that the district court in the minutes, in the transcript or in the order, considered the provisions or applied the provisions of 163.4185. Is that true?
The order addresses 1207, which then implicates 4105. So I believe that's true.
What I said was true.
Yes, that's what
I thank you.
Okay. Yes,
thank you.
I move on to my second point, and that's the difference between a discretionary interest and a mandatory interest, and that's important here. One of the important distinctions is what I just mentioned. Subsection 1C is conjunctive, and subsection 1A is disjunctive. So for an interest to be mandatory, you only have to establish that there is no discretion for the trustee as to whether a distribution should be made, when it should be made, and how much. And Section 2.2 of the trust is very clear. At 35, we're to distribute one-third, 40, one-half, and 45, the entire remainder. So on those points, when those events occur, the trustee has no discretion on all three. But even if the trustee had no discretion on just one of those points, that characterizes it as a mandatory interest.
Let me ask you this. As far as accounting is concerned, during a discretionary period, what would the trust beneficiaries do in any event? They found it's a discretionary trust until they reach a certain age, and it becomes a mandatory. What is the purpose of the accounting?
The purpose of the accounting during the discretionary period, even though they have two interests, I think is simply the issue of transparency. The overall purpose of this trust, as I mentioned earlier, is to provide for the benefit of these two beneficiaries, Keeley and Brindley. And so ultimately, whether...
So there's language in the trust document that basically makes it support trust.
It's a support, under Section 2.1, it's a support specifically under a HEMP standard, yes.
Okay.
And so whether the trust is ultimately distributed under Section 2.1 or 2.2, ultimately the trust will be distributed to Keeley and Brindley. And that's what makes this different than a scenario, as I mentioned earlier, where you have one beneficiary who is a current discretionary beneficiary, another who is a mandatory remainder. Because the sole beneficiaries of these trusts are Keeley and Brindley, they have an interest now in obtaining an accounting. If there is waste being done with the trust now, it would prevent them from obtaining distribution later under the mandatory remainder in Section 2.2 of the trust.
So what's their recourse at that point?
If there's been a breach?
A breach of a discretionary trust?
Well, I don't know that...
A breach of trust agreements regarding support provisions.
Yeah. Obviously, I think there would be a breach of fiduciary duty claim, but I want to be very clear that a breach of fiduciary duty in this scenario wouldn't necessarily mean that there's a disagreement about how the HEMS standard is applied, that would be something, I think, probably more serious, but it would still be nonetheless a breach and would still have to be addressed through a claim.
Mr. Krover, just to make sure we're communicating, you've used the term HEMS standard several times. You mean health, education, and maintenance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for clarifying. Yes, HEMS, health, education, maintenance, and support.
Okay.
And that is the guideline.
And that is the provision that's contained in 2.1.
That's right.
All right.
Yes, that's correct. And that's why we could characterize Section 2.1, as I discussed earlier, as a support interest, because it contains the parameters and the language that the trustee must follow in exercising the discretion. So in other words, the trustee's discretion is not boundless in this type of trust. Yes, operating within health, education, maintenance, and support to beneficiaries. And while there's a lot of discretion, it's not limitless by any means. Another point, when we're talking about the difference between a discretionary and a mandatory interest, in the briefing, the appellants quote the definitions of a remainder beneficiary and then come to the conclusion that a remainder beneficiary doesn't have rights. And this goes kind of back to my first point, which is the plain meaning of the statute. If the remainder beneficiary truly had no rights, we would end up with language that is surplusage in Section 12071B. And I'm going to go to that. That's the general rule that we're dealing with here, the exceptions being attempted to be applied to.
But Mr. Grover, I hate to harp on this point, but the basis of the district court's decision was that because of the remainder interest that existed under the mandatory distribution, ultimate mandatory distribution, that the accounting was warranted.
Right.
But there's nothing in 163.4185 that even addresses remainder interest.
Well,
the issue about whether or not an accounting is required is based upon the nature of the trust, whether it's a mandatory, support, or discretionary trust, not whether the interests are remainder or even contingent.
That is true, that the right to an accounting is based upon whether it's mandatory or discretionary. I think that is where the language of 1207.1A becomes so critical. And that is that the right to an accounting is given as a general rule to each beneficiary and to each remainder beneficiary of the trust. And that's true whether, and that's the key language, is the plain. And if we were to interpret the exception under 1B5 to mean that a remainder beneficiary has no rights, it would render the language in 1A surplusage, specifically the language and to each remainder beneficiary of the trust.
But isn't that the point of subsection 5? It creates an exception to the general rule that you're just now talking about.
Right, and so what would happen if we interpret subsection 5 that way, the exception would swallow the rule. There would never be a circumstance where the general rule would apply to a remainder beneficiary of the trust. In other words, every time that we had a remainder beneficiary, we interpret them to have no rights at all, then the only person that could have the right to an accounting under the general rule of 1A would be a current beneficiary.
But isn't an alternative to that approach that if the trust one is dealing with is a mandatory interest trust or a support interest trust, the remainder beneficiary is entitled to a complete accounting? It's only in instances in which there is a discretionary interest, or as suggested in subsection 3, a hybrid that creates a discretionary interest, where the accounting is not required.
Well, I think
isn't that a reasonable interpretation of those statutes?
The concern I have with that interpretation, Your Honor, is that if under that interpretation, a person who has only a remainder interest would have the rights to an accounting whereas a person who has a current discretionary interest and a remaining interest would have fewer rights. Even so, though, they would have two interests and the same mandatory remainder interest, that person would have fewer rights because they have a current discretionary interest.
Wasn't subsection 5 made at the request of the probate and trust section of the state bar?
It was, and in the record, you've probably noticed that Leah Rushford, who was a member of that committee, who drafted these documents, has stated the purpose of this was not to circumscribe the rights of people who have two interests, the current discretionary interest and the mandatory remainder interest, but to increase transparency and accountability. And so, yes, the probate section, we did put these together. That's normally the practice. And that affidavit from Mr. Rushforth sets forth
But the exception was connected to the definitions of these different trusts in 163.4185.
They definitely implicate section 4.4185, especially 1C, 1A, and 1C. There's no question about that. Unless the court has any other further questions.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Shapiro. Mr. Shapiro, and rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll just touch on a couple of points. One, there's been some discussion about transparency. Transparency is the reason for the general rule. There's a reason there's an accounting required, but the legislature specifically enacted an exception to that rule. And so the transparency argument really doesn't carry weight when the legislature made a conscious decision to provide an exception to the rule requiring an accounting. The other point that I want to make is that there was no attempt to explain even a scenario where you could apply 165.1207.1b5 and give effect to the word while if you don't apply it as we are proposing in this scenario. To give effect to that word, you have to look at the timing, again, assuming that your argument does apply, but I think it does. I think that subsection 3 of 163.4185 applies as well. So unless there's questions, I'll submit.
Thanks to both counsel for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter stands submitted. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.